I think you're right about that. Then maybe you could go on to Ninth Cave to get Rilona here, and Zelindani too, Joharan said. Tell Proliva what happened. She'll know how to get everything organized. Zelindani should be the one to tell Chevenar's mate. She may want you to explain to Rilona what happened, but leave it up to her. Joharan turned to face the hunters that were still standing around the wounded man, most of them from the Ninth Cave. Rushamar, the sun is high and getting hotter. We've paid dearly for this day's kill. Let's not waste it. The bison need to be gutted and skinned. Kareja and the 11th Cave have started, but I'm sure she could use some help. Soliban, maybe you could take a few people and help Bramival get wood and water and whatever else Ayla needs. And when Kimaran and Thafona find a place, you can help move Chevenar.
Someone should go to the other caves and let them know we need help,
Bramival said.
Jondalar, can you stop on your way back and let them know what happened?
Joharan asked.
When you get to Two Rivers Rock, tell them to light the signal fire, Manvalar said.
Good idea, Joharan said. Then the caves will know something is wrong and will be expecting a messenger.
He went to the woman, the foreigner, who would likely be a member of his cave one day, and probably a Zelindani, and was already contributing every way she could.
Do what you can for him, Ayla. We'll get his mate and Zelindani here as soon as we can. If there's anything you need, ask Soliban. He'll get it for you.
Thank you, Joharan, she said, then turned to Jondalar. If you tell her what happened, I'm sure Zelindani will know what to bring, but let me check my bag. There are a couple of herbs I'd like if she has them. And take Quinny with you. Then you can use the pole drag to bring things here. She's more used to it than Racer. Zelindani could even ride here on it, and Chevenar's mate on Winnie's back, if they're willing.
I don't know, Ayla. Zelindani's pretty heavy,
Jondalar said. I'm sure Winnie can handle it. You just have to come up with a comfortable seat.
Then she looked at Jondalar with a wry expression.
But you're right. Most people aren't used to using horses for traveling. I'm sure the women would rather walk. But they will need tents and supplies. The pole drag will be good for that.
Ayla removed the carrying baskets before she put the halter on Winnie and gave the rope attached to it to Jondalar.
He fastened the other end of it to the back of Racer's halter with enough lead so she could follow and started out. But the mare was not accustomed to trailing behind the stallion she had borne. He had always followed her. Even though Jondalar was sitting on Racer's back, guiding him with a rein attached to his halter, Winnie stayed slightly ahead of them, yet she seemed to sense which way the man wanted to go. Horses were willing to do the bidding of their human friends, Ayla thought, smiling to herself as she watched them leave, so long as it didn't upset their own sense of the proper order of things. She saw Wolf was observing her when she turned around. She had signaled him to stay when the horses left. Now he was waiting patiently. Her ironic inner smile at the behavior of the horses was quickly dispelled when she looked at the man lying where he fell.
"He'll need to be carried, Joharan," she said.
The leader nodded, then called on some people to help. They improvised a carrying device by first binding together a couple of spears to make a sturdy pole, then fastening pieces of clothing across two of them. By the time Thafona and Kimaran returned with news of a small shelter nearby, the man had been carefully moved to the stretcher and was ready to be carried. Ayla called Wolf to her as four men each lifted one end of a pole. When they arrived, Ayla helped several people who had begun cleaning out the hollowed-out space at ground level in the nearby limestone wall, protected by a small overhanging ledge. The dirt floor was littered with dried leaves and debris blown in by the wind, and dried hyena droppings left some time before by the scavenging carnivores who had used the place for a lair. Ayla was pleased to find that water was close by. There was a smaller cave at the back of the sheltered depression, and just inside it was a spring-fed pool of fresh water that ran off in a ditch that had formed along the cliff wall.
She told Soliban where to set up a fireplace with the wood he and Bramival, and a few others, had brought. When Ayla asked, several people volunteered their sleeping rolls, which were piled on top of each other to create a slightly raised bed. The injured man had awakened when they moved him onto the stretcher, but was unconscious by the time he arrived at the shelter. He moaned in pain when they moved him to the bed and awoke again, grimacing and struggling to breathe. Ayla folded another bedroll and propped him up on it to try to make him more comfortable. He tried to smile his thanks, but coughed up blood instead. She wiped his chin with a piece of soft rabbit skin, an item she usually kept with her medicinals. Ayla went through the limited supplies in her medicine bag and tried to think if there was anything she might have forgotten that would help allay his pain. Gentian roots might help, or a wash of arnica. Both could relieve the internal pain of bruises and other aches, but she had neither with her. The fine hairs on the fruit of hops could be used as a sedative to help him relax just by breathing the air near them, but they were not readily available. Maybe something in smoke would help, since swallowing liquid was not going to be possible. No, it would probably make him cough, which would be worse. She knew it was hopeless. It was just a matter of time, but she had to do something, at least for his pain. Wait, she thought. Didn't I see that plant from the Valerian family on the way here? The one with the aromatic roots? One of the Mamuti at the summer meeting called it spikenard. I don't know the name in Zelandani. She looked up at the people around her and saw the young woman that Manvalar seemed to have a lot of respect for, the lookout from the third cave, the Fona. The Fona had stayed to help clean out the small shelter she found and was still there, watching Ayla. The foreign woman intrigued her. There was something about her that made people pay attention to her, and she seemed to have gained the respect of the ninth cave in the short time she had been there. The Fona wondered how much the woman really knew about healing. She didn't have any kind of tattoo marks, like the Zelandanya did. But the people she came from might have different ways. Some people tried to fool others about what they knew, but the stranger didn't seem to be trying to impress anyone by bragging or talking big. Instead, she did things that were genuinely impressive, like the way she used that spear-throwing thing. The Fona had been thinking about Ayla, but was surprised when the woman called her name.
"The Fona, may I ask you something?"
Ayla said.
"Yes,"
the Fona said, and thought, "She does have a strange way of talking. Not her words, but the way they sound. Maybe that's why she doesn't talk much."
"Do you know much about plants?"
"Everyone knows something about plants," the Fona said.
"I'm thinking about one whose leaves resemble foxglove, but it has yellow flowers like dandelions. The name I know it by is spikenard. But that's a Mamutoi word."
"I'm sorry. I know some food plants. I don't know much about medicine plants. You would need a Zelandani for that," the Fona said. Ayla paused, then said,
"Would you watch Chevonarth, Fona? I thought I noticed some spikenard on my way here. I'm going back the way we came and look for it. If he wakes up again, or if there is any change at all, would you send someone to find me?"
Ayla said. Then she decided to add an explanation, though explaining her actions as a medicine woman was not something she usually did.
"If it is what I think it is, it could be helpful. I've used the mashed roots as a poultice to help mend bone fractures, but it is easily absorbed and has soothing powers. If I mix it with a little datura and maybe some pulverized yarrow leaves, I think it might help ease his pain. I want to see if I can find it."
"Yes, of course I'll watch him,"
the Fona said, pleased, for some unknown reason, that the foreign woman had asked for her help. Joharan and Manvalar were talking to Ranakal in quiet tones, but even though they were right next to her, Ayla hardly heard them. She was concentrating on the wounded man and watching the water heating, far too slowly. Wolf was lying on the ground nearby with his head between his paws, watching her every move. When the water began to steam, she added the spikenard roots so they would soften enough to be pounded into a mash for a poultice. She had been glad to find Comfrey as well. A wet dressing of the fresh crushed roots and leaves was also good for bruises and fractures, and while she didn't think it would mend Chevenar's injuries, she was willing to try anything that might ease his pain. When it was ready, she plastered the warm mashed root directly on the almost black bruise that was spreading down his chest to his stomach. She noticed his abdomen was getting hard. His eyes opened while she was covering it with a piece of leather to keep it warm.
"Chevenard,"
she said. His eyes seemed aware but puzzled. Perhaps he didn't recognize her, she thought.
"My name is Ayla. Your mate,"
she hesitated, then remembered her name.
"Relona is on her way here."
He took a breath and winced with pain. It seemed to surprise him.
"You were hurt, Chevenard, by a bison. Zelandani is on her way, too. I am trying to help until she gets here. I put a poultice on your chest to draw out some of the pain."
He nodded, but even that was an effort.
"Do you want to see your brother? He's been waiting to see you."
He nodded again, and Ayla got up and went to the men waiting nearby.
"He's awake. He'd like to see you," she said to Ranakal.
The young man quickly got up and went to his brother's bed. Ayla followed, along with Joharan and Manvalar.
"How are you feeling?" Ranakal said.
Chevenar tried to smile, but it turned into a grimace of pain as an unexpected cough brought up a drool of red out of the corner of his mouth. A look of panic filled his brother's eyes, but then he noticed the plaster on his brother's chest.
"What is this?" Ranakal said, his voice taut, almost a squeal.
"It is a poultice for his pain."
Ayla's voice was normally rather low-pitched, and she said the words slowly and calmly. She understood the panic and fear of the man's brother.
"Who told you to do anything to him? It's probably making him worse. Get this off him!" he screamed.
"No, Ranakal,"
Chevenar said. The voice of the injured man could hardly be heard.
"Not her fault. Helps."
He tried to sit up, then collapsed, unconscious.
"Chevenar! Wake up, Chevenar!"
"He's dead! Oh, great mother, he's dead!"
Ranakal cried, slumping down on the bed beside his brother. Ayla checked Chevenar's pulse while Joharan pulled Ranakal away.
"No, he's not dead yet," she said, "but he doesn't have long. I hope his mate arrives soon."
"He's not dead, Ranakal, but he could have been," Joharan said angrily. "This woman may not be Zelandani, but she knows how to help. You're the one who's making him worse. Who knows if he'll wake up again to say his last words to Relona?"
"No one can make him worse, Joharan. There is no hope for him. He may go any time." "Don't blame a man grieving for his brother," Ayla said, then moved to get up. "Let me make some tea to settle everyone."
"You don't have to, Ayla. I will. Just tell me what to make."
Ayla looked up and saw Thafona and smiled.
"If you just get some water boiling, I'll get something for all of us," she said.
Then she turned back to check on Chevenar. He struggled with every difficult breath he took. She wanted to make him more comfortable, but when she tried to move him, he moaned in pain. She shook her head, surprised that he was still alive, then reached for her medicine bag to see what she had to make tea. Perhaps chamomile, she thought, with dried linden flowers, or licorice root to sweeten it. The long afternoon wore on. People came and went, but Ayla didn't notice them. Chevenar regained consciousness and asked for his mate, then slipped back into a restless sleep several times. His stomach was distended and hard, and the skin was almost black. She felt sure he was trying to hold on just to see her again. Somewhat later, Ayla picked up her water bag to get a drink, found it empty, then put it down and forgot about her thirst. Portula had come into the small shelter to see how things were. She still felt self-conscious about her part in Morona's trick, and tried to stay out of the way,
but she saw Ayla pick up the water bag, shake it, and find it empty. Portula hurried to the pool, filled her own water bag, and returned with the cold water.
"Would you like a drink, Ayla?"
she asked, holding out her dripping water bag. Ayla looked up and was surprised to see the woman.
"Thank you,"
she said, holding out her drinking cup.
"I was a little thirsty."
Portula stood there for a moment after Ayla was through, looking uncomfortable.
"I want to apologize to you,"
she finally said.
"I'm sorry I let Morona talk me into playing that joke on you. It was not a very nice thing to do. I don't know what to say."
"There really isn't anything to say, is there, Portula?" Ayla said. "And I did get a warm and comfortable hunting outfit, though I doubt that was what Morona intended. I will get use out of it, so let's just forget about it."
"Is there anything I can do to help?" Portula said. "There isn't anything anyone can do to help. I'm surprised he is still with us. He asks for his mate when he wakes up. Joharin told him she is on her way," Ayla said. "I think he's holding on for her. I only wish I could do more to make it easier for him, but most medicines that alleviate pain have to be swallowed. I've given him a skin soaked with water to wet his mouth, but with his injury, I'm afraid if he drank anything, it would make it worse."
Joharin was out in front of the shelter, looking south, the way Jandalar had gone, anxiously waiting for his return with Rilona. The sun was falling low in the west, and darkness would follow soon. He had sent people to collect more wood so they could build up a large bonfire to help guide them. They were even taking some from the surround. The last time Chevenar woke, his eyes were glazed, and the leader knew death was near. The young man had put up such a brave struggle to cling to a last shred of life, Joharin hoped his mate would arrive before he lost the battle. Finally, in the distance, he saw movement, something approaching. He hurried in that direction and was relieved to see a horse. When they were closer, he went to Rilona and guided the distraught woman to the stone shelter where her mate lay dying. As she drew near, Ayla gently touched the man's arm.
"Chevenar, Chevenar, Rilona's here."
She moved his arm again. He opened his eyes and looked at Ayla.
"She's here. Rilona's here," she said.
Chevenar closed his eyes again and shook his head slightly, trying to make himself wake up.
"Chevenar, it's me. I came as fast as I could. Talk to me. Please talk to me."
Rilona's voice cracked in a sob. The injured man opened his eyes and fought to focus on the face bending near.
"Rilona,"
he said. It was barely audible. The start of a smile was erased by an expression of pain. He looked again at the woman and watched her eyes fill with tears.
"Don't cry,"
he whispered, then closed his eyes and struggled to breathe. Rilona's eyes were pleading when she looked up at Ayla, who looked down, then back up and shook her head. She glanced around in panic, desperately searching out someone else who would give her another answer, but no one would return her gaze. She looked back at the man and watched him strain to take a breath, then saw blood spill from the corner of his mouth.
"Chevenar,"
she cried, and reached for his hand.
"Rilona, wanted to see you once more,"
he gasped, opening his eyes.
"Say goodbye before I walk the spirit world. If Donnie allows, we'll see you there."
He closed his eyes, and they heard a feeble rattle as he tried to draw in a breath. Then a low moan grew louder, and though Ayla was sure he was trying to control it, the sound increased. He stopped and tried to take a breath. Then Ayla thought she heard a muted popping sound from inside him as he suddenly cried out in an agonizing scream. When the sound died away, he breathed no more.
"No! No! Chevenar! Chevenar!"
Rilona cried. She laid her head on his chest and heaved great sobs of sorrow and grief. Ranakol was standing beside her with tears running down his cheeks, looking bewildered, dazed, at a loss. He didn't know what to do. Suddenly they were startled by a loud and eerie howl at close quarters that sent shivers down their backs. As one, they looked at Wolf. He was standing on all four legs, with his head thrown back, wailing a spine-tingling wolf song.
"What's he doing?"
Ranicole said, quite upset.
"He is grieving for your brother," said the familiar voice of Zelandani, "as we all do."
Everyone was relieved to see her. She had arrived with Rolona and several others, but had stayed back to observe when Chevenar's mate rushed ahead. Rolona's sobs turned to a wailing moan, a keening of her grief. Zelandani joined her in her anguished lament, then several others. Wolf howled along with them. Finally, Ranicle broke down sobbing and threw himself across the man on the bed. An instant later, he and Rolona were clinging together, rocking and keening their sorrow. Ayla thought it was good for both of them. To alleviate his pain and anger, she knew Ranicle needed to let his grief out, and Rolona had helped him. When Wolf howled again, she joined him in a howl so realistic, many thought at first it was another wolf. Then, to the surprise of those who had kept a vigil for the man in the shelter, from a distance they heard another wolf howl, joining in the keening wolf song of grief. After a while, the Danyer helped Rolona up and led her to a fur that had been spread on the ground near the fire. Joharan helped the man's brother to a place on the other side of the hearth. The woman sat there rocking back and forth, making a low moaning sound, indifferent to everything around her. Ranicle just sat staring blankly at the fire. The Zelandani of the third spoke quietly with the huge Zelandani from the ninth cave, and shortly after returned with a steaming cup of liquid in each hand. The Danyer of the ninth cave took one cup from the third and urged it on Rolona, who drank it without objection, as though she didn't know or care what she did. The third's other cup was brought to Ranicle, who ignored the proffered drink, but after some urging he finally drank it. Soon both of them were lying on the furs near the fire, asleep.
"I'm glad to see her quieted," Joharan said, "and him, too."
"They needed to grieve," Ayla said.
"Yes, they did, but now they need to rest," Zelandani said, "and so do you, Ayla."
"Have something to eat first," Proliva said.
Joharan's mate had come with Rolona and Zelandani and a few others from the ninth cave.
"We roasted some bison meat, and the third cave brought other food." "I'm not hungry," Ayla said.
"But you must be tired," Joharan said. "You hardly left his side for a moment."
"I wish I could have done more for him. I couldn't think of anything to help him," Ayla said, shaking her head and looking dejected.
"But you did," said the older man, who was the Zelandani of the third. "You eased his pain. No one could have done more, and he wouldn't have held on to life without your help. I would not have used a poultice in that way. To ease aches or bruises, yes, but for internal injuries, I don't think I would have thought of it. Yet it did seem to help."
"Yes, it was a perceptive way to treat him," the ninth's Zelandani said. "Have you done that before?"
"No, and I wasn't sure it would help, but I had to try something," Ayla said.
"You did well," the Danyer said. "But now you should have something to eat and rest."
"No, nothing to eat, but I think I will lie down for a while," Ayla said. "Where's Jandalar?"
"He went out with Rushamar and Soliban and a couple of others to get more wood. Some went along just to hold torches, but Jandalar wanted to be sure there would be enough to last the night, and this valley doesn't have many trees. They should be back soon. Jandalar, put your sleeping furs over there,"
Joharan said, showing her the place. Ayla lay down, thinking to rest a while until Jandalar came back. She was asleep almost as soon as she closed her eyes. When the fuel collectors returned with the wood, nearly everyone was asleep. They put it in a pile near the fireplace, then went to the sleeping places they had chosen. Jandalar noticed the wooden bowl she usually took with her and used to heat small amounts of water with hot stones for medicinal teas. She had also constructed a makeshift framework of antlers, shed the previous season, to support a water bag directly over a flame. Although the deer bladder held water, it seeped a little, which prevented it from catching on fire when it was used for heating water or cooking. Joharan stopped his brother to talk for a few moments.
Jandalar, I want to learn more about those spear throwers. I saw that bison fall from your spear and you were farther away than most. If we'd all had that weapon, we wouldn't have had to get so close and Chevenar might not have been trampled. You know I'll show anyone who wants to learn, but it does take practice,
Jandalar said.
How long did it take you? I don't mean to be as good as you are now, but to gain enough skill to really hunt with it,
Joharan asked.
We've been using the spear throwers for a few years now, but by the end of the first summer we were hunting with them,
Jandalar said.
It wasn't until the journey back that we got good at hunting from the backs of horses, though. Wolf can be a help, too. It's still hard to get used to the idea of using animals for anything besides meat or fur,
Joharan said.
I wouldn't have believed you could if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, but it's that spear thrower I want to know more about. We'll talk tomorrow.
The brothers bade a good night to each other. Then Jandalar went to where Ayla was sleeping and joined her. Wolf looked up. He watched her breathing quietly in the glow from the fire, then back at the wolf. I'm glad he's always there watching out for her, he thought, and stroked his head. Then he slipped in beside her. He was sorry Chevenar had died, not only because he was a member of the Ninth Cave, but because he knew how hard it was on Ayla when someone died and there was nothing she could do. She was a healer, but there were some wounds no one could heal. Zelandani had been busy all morning, preparing the body of Chevenar to be carried back to the Ninth Cave. Being near someone whose spirit had left the body was very disturbing for most people, and his burial would involve more than the usual ritual. It was considered very bad luck if someone died while hunting. If they were alone, the bad luck was obvious, the misfortune had been accomplished, but a Zelandani usually performed a cleansing ritual to ward off any possible future effects. If two or three hunters went out and one of them died, it was still considered a personal matter, and a ceremony with the survivors and family members was adequate. But when someone died on a hunt that involved not just one cave but the whole community, that was serious. Something on a community level had to be done. The one who was first was thinking about what might be needed, perhaps a prohibition on the hunting of bison for the rest of the season to assuage the ill fortune, might be required. Ayla saw her relaxing with a cup of tea near the fire, sitting on a stack of several thickly stuffed pads that had been brought for her on Winnie's pole drag. She seldom sat on low cushions, finding it more and more difficult and cumbersome to get up as she grew more corpulent with each year. Ayla approached the Danyar.
Zelandani, can I talk to you?
Yes, of course.
If you're too busy, it can wait. I just wanted to ask you something,
Ayla said. I can spare a little time now, Zelandani said.
Get a cup for tea and join me.
She motioned to Ayla to sit on a mat on the ground.
I just wanted to ask you if you know of anything more that I could have done for Chevenar. Is there any way to heal internal wounds? When I lived with a clan, there was a man who had been accidentally stabbed with a knife. A piece broke off inside, and Issa cut in and removed it. But I don't think there was a way to cut in and fix Chevenar's wounds,
Ayla said. It was obvious how much it bothered the foreign woman that she had been able to do so little for the man, and Zelandani was moved by her concern. It was the sort of thing a good acolyte might feel.
There is not much that can be done to help anyone who's been stepped on by a full-grown bison, Ayla, Zelandani said. Some lumps and swellings can be lanced to drain, or small objects cut out. Slivers, or that broken piece of the knife that your clan woman removed. But that was a brave thing for her to do. It is dangerous to cut into the body. You are creating an injury that often is bigger than the one you're trying to fix. I have cut in a few times, but only when I was sure it would help, and there was no other way.
That's how I feel, Ayla said.
It's also necessary to know something about what the inside of the body is like. There are many similarities between the inside of a human body and the inside of an animal's body, and I have often butchered an animal very carefully to see what it looks like and how they are connected. It's easy to see the tubes that carry blood from the heart and the sinew that moves the muscles. Those things are very similar in all animals. But some things are different. An auroch's stomach is different from a horse's, for example, and many things are arranged differently. It can be useful and quite interesting.
I have found that to be true, Ayla said. I've hunted and butchered many animals, and it does help to understand about people. I am sure Chavanar's ribs were broken, and splinters had penetrated his breathing sacs.
Lungs.
His lungs, and I think his other organs. In Mamutoi, I would say liver and spleen. I don't know the words in Zelandanyi. They bleed heavily when damaged. Do you know which ones I mean? Ayla said.
Yes, I do, the first said.
The blood had no place to go. I think that's why he turned black and got so hard. It filled him up inside until something burst, Ayla said.
I examined him, and I agree with your assessment. The blood filled his stomach and some of his intestines. I believe part of the intestines burst, the Danyer said.
The intestines are the long tubes that lead to the outside?
Yes.
Jandalar taught me that word. They were damaged on Chavanar too, I think. But it was the blood filling him up inside that made him die.
Yes. The small bone in his left lower leg was also broken, and his right wrist, but those would not have been fatal, of course, Zelandani said.
No, and I wasn't so concerned about those breaks. I just wondered if you knew of anything else that I could have done for him, Ayla said, her earnest face full of concern.
It bothers you that you couldn't save him, doesn't it?
Ayla nodded and lowered her head.
You did everything you could, Ayla. We will all walk in the world of the spirit some day. When Dani calls us, young or old, we have no choice. Not even a Zelandani is gifted enough to stop it, or even to know when it will happen. That is a secret Dani shares with no one. She allowed the spirit of the bison to take Chavanar in exchange for the bison we took. It is a sacrifice she sometimes demands. Perhaps she felt we needed to be reminded that her gifts should not be taken for granted. We kill her creatures so that we may live, but we need to appreciate the gift of life she has given us when we take the lives of her animals. The Great Mother is not always gentle. Sometimes her lessons are hard.
Yes, that is what I have learned. I do not think the spirit world is a gentle place. The lessons are hard, but valuable, Ayla said.
Zelandani did not reply. She had found that people often kept on talking to fill the gap if she did not respond immediately, and she often learned more from her silence than she would have from asking questions. After a time, Ayla did continue.
I remember when Kreb told me that the spirit of the cave lion had chosen me. He said the cave lion was a strong totem who would offer powerful protection, but that strong totems are hard to live with. He told me if I paid attention, my totem would help me and let me know when I'd made the right decision. But he said totems test you to make sure you are worthy before they give you something. He also said the cave lion would not have chosen me if I was not worthy, Ayla said. Maybe he meant able to bear it.
The Danyer was surprised at the depth of understanding Ayla's comment showed. Were the people that she called clan really capable of such perception? If she had said the Great Earth Mother instead of the spirit of the cave lion, the words could have come from a Zelandani. Finally, the one who was first continued.
Nothing could be done for Chavanar except to ease his pain, and you did that. Using a poultice was an intriguing approach. Did you learn that from your clan woman?
No, Ayla said, shaking her head. I've never done that before. But he was in so much pain, and I knew with his injuries I couldn't give him anything liquid to drink. I thought of using smoke. I've burned mullein to make a smoke that alleviates certain coughs, and I know plants that are sometimes burned in sweat lodges, but I was afraid that it might make him cough, and with his damaged breathing sacs, I didn't want to do that. Then I noticed the bruising, though it was more than that, I think. The bruise on his skin turned almost black after a while, but I know that certain plants can ease the pain of bruising when put on the skin. And I happened to notice some on the way here from the hunting surround. So I went back and got some. It seemed to help a little.
Yes, I think it did, the Danyer said. I may try that sometime myself. You do seem to have a natural, inborn sense about healing, Ayla. And I think it's telling that you feel bad. Every good healer that I know is always bothered when someone is lost. But there was nothing more you could have done. The mother decided to call him, and no one can thwart her will.
You're right, of course, Zelandani. I didn't think there was any hope, but I wanted to ask anyway. I know you have much to do, and I don't want to take any more of your time, Ayla said, as she got up to leave. Thank you for answering my questions.
Zelandani watched the young woman as she started to walk away. Ayla, she called. I wonder if you would do something for me.
Of course, anything, Zelandani, she said.
When we get back to the ninth cave, will you dig up some red ochre? There is an embankment near the river by the big rock. Do you know where that is?
Yes, I saw the ochre when Jondalar and I went swimming. It's very bright red, more red than most. I'll get some for you.
I will tell you how to purify your hands and give you a special basket for it when we get back, Zelandani said. Chapter 14. It was a somber group of people that returned to the ninth cave the next day. The hunt had been eminently successful, but the cost had been too dear. As soon as they arrived, Joharan turned Chevenar's body over to the Zelandanya to prepare it for burial. It was taken to the far end of the shelter, near the bridge up to Down River, to be ritually washed and dressed in his ceremonial clothing and jewelry by Zelandani, Rilona, and several others. Ayla, Zelandani called as she was walking back to Marthona's dwelling. We're going to be needing that red ochre you said you would get for me.
I'll go get it right away, Ayla said.
Come with me. I'll give you a special basket and something to dig it with, the woman said. Zelandani led her to her dwelling and held the drape aside so Ayla could enter. She had never been inside the Danyer's home before, and she looked around with interest. Something about it reminded her of Issa's hearth, perhaps the many drying leaves and other parts of plants that were hanging from cords strung across the back end of the main room. There were several raised beds against the wall panels in the front part, though she was sure that was not where the large woman slept. There appeared to be two other rooms partitioned off. Glancing through the opening, she saw that one of them appeared to be a cooking area. She guessed the other might be a sleeping room. "Here's the basket and the pick for collecting the red earth," Zelandani said, giving her a sturdy container stained red from use and an adze-like digging tool firmly attached to an antler handle. Ayla left Zelandani's dwelling carrying the basket and pick. Zelandani walked out with her and started toward the south end of the shelter. Wolf had found a place where he liked to rest on the stone porch out of the way, but where he could watch the activities. When he saw Ayla, he immediately ran to her. The Danyer stopped. "I think it might be wise if you kept Wolf away from the body of Chevenar," she said, "for his own protection. Until the man is safely buried in sacred ground, his life spirit is floating free and very confused. I know how to protect people, but I'm not sure how to defend a wolf, and I'm concerned
that Chevenar's Elan might try to inhabit this animal. I have seen wolves go mad and foam at the mouth. I believe they are trying to fight off something, maybe something evil or a bewildered spirit. The bite of such an animal will kill like a deadly poison.
I will look for Folara and ask her to watch him when I bring the red ochre, Ayla said.
Wolf followed along behind her as she walked down the path toward the place where she and Jandalar had gone swimming and cleaned themselves shortly after they arrived. She filled the basket nearly full, then started back up the path. She saw Folara talking to her mother and explained Zelandani's request. The young woman grinned, delighted to stay with the wolf. Her mother had just asked her to come and help prepare the body. It was not something she wanted to do, and she knew Marthona would not refuse Ayla's request.
It may be best to keep him inside Marthona's dwelling. If you want to go out, I have a special rope that can be put around his neck in a way that won't choke him. Wolf doesn't like it much, but he'll put up with it. Come with me, and I'll show you how to put it on him, Ayla said.
Then she walked to the far end of the ledge and gave the red ochre to the first. She stayed to help clean and dress the body of Chevenar. Jandalar's mother soon came to help as well. She had done it many times before, and told Ayla that Folara had invited several young people to their dwelling, and Wolf seemed content to be with them. Ayla was intrigued by the clothing they put on the dead hunter, though she was reluctant to mention her interest at the time. The outfit consisted of a loose, soft tunic made of the furs of different animals and hides tanned and colored in various shades that were sewn together into intricate patterns and accented with beads, shells, and fringes. The tunic was bloused and belted at the hips with a colorful band of woven fabric. The leggings, though less elaborate, matched the tunic, as did the calf-high foot coverings, which had a fringe and an edging of fur attached to the tops. Necklaces made of shells, beads, various animal teeth, and ivory carvings had been placed around his neck and artfully arranged. Then the body was laid out on blocks of limestone, on top of a large, somewhat flexible, blanket-size mat of grasses woven with designs that were colored with red ochre. Long cords were strung through each end, which Marthona explained to Ayla could be pulled together so that the mat would envelop him. The lengths of cordage would then be wrapped around the shrouded body and tied. Beneath the mat was a strong netting made of flax cordage, which could be slung from a pole like a hammock so that he could be carried to the sacred ground and lowered into the grave. Chevenar had been a spearmaker, and his tools for making them were placed beside him, along with some finished spears and the parts of some he had been working on, which included wooden shafts, ivory and flint points, and the sinew, cords, and glue used to attach them. The sinew and cords were used to fasten the points to the shafts and to bind sections of shorter pieces of wood together to make longer spears, which were then cemented with resinous pitch or glue. Rilona had brought the things from their dwelling, and she sobbed with grief when she placed Chevenar's favorite shaft straightener within easy reach of his right hand. It was made of an antler of a red deer, the stem part, from the horn core at the head to the first branching tines. After the tines had been cut off, a good-sized hole was bored through the wide end where the antler had begun to branch out. Ayla recognized that it was similar to the tool Jandalar had brought back with them that had belonged to his brother, Thanalan. Depictions of animals, including a stylized mountain sheep with large horns and various symbols, had been carved into the device. She recalled Jandalar saying that they lent potency to the shaft straightener so that the spears made with it would fly straight and true and would have a compelling attractiveness to the animal at which they were aimed, to make a clean kill. That they also added a pleasing aesthetic touch was appreciated.
While Chevenar's body was being prepared under the supervision of Zelandani, Joharan was directing others to construct a temporary shelter with a roof-like covering made of a thin layer of thatched grasses supported by poles. When the body was ready, the shelter was placed over him, then walled with quickly made movable panels. The Zelandanya entered the shelter to perform the ritual that would keep the free-floating spirit close to the body and within the shelter. When they finished, everyone who had touched or handled or worked close to the man whose life force had left his body had to be ritually cleaned themselves. Water was the element that was used, and flowing water was considered best for this particular cleansing. They were all required to immerse themselves completely in the river. Whether they undressed or were fully clothed didn't matter. They followed the path down to the riverbank below the stone shelf. The Zelandanya invoked the Great Mother. Then the women went upstream a ways, and the men downstream. All of the women removed their clothing, but a few of the men jumped in clothing and all. Jandalar had helped build the burial shelter. He and the others who had erected the shelter around the body were also required to be purified in the river. Afterwards, he walked with Ayla back up the path. Proliva had arranged to have a meal ready for them. Marthona sat with Jandalar and Ayla, and Zelandani joined them after a while, leaving the grieving widow with her family. Willemar came looking for Marthona and sat with them also. While she was with people with whom she felt comfortable, Ayla thought this would be a good time to ask about the clothing they had put on Chevenar's body. "Does everyone who dies get dressed in such special clothes?" she asked. "It must have taken a lot of work to make Chevenar's outfit." "Most people want to wear their best clothes for special occasions or when they first meet people. That's why they have ceremonial clothes. They want to be recognized and make a good impression. Since people don't know what to expect when they reach the next world, they want to make the right impression there, and they want whoever they meet to know who they are," Marthona said. "I didn't think clothes went to the next world," Ayla said. "It's the spirit that goes. The body stays here, doesn't it?"
"The body returns to the womb of the Great Earth Mother," Zelandani said. "The life spirit, the Elan, returns to her spirit in the next world. But everything has a spirit form, rocks, trees, the food we eat, even the clothes we wear. The Elan of a person doesn't want to return naked or empty-handed. That's why Chevenar was dressed in his ceremonial clothes and given the tools of his craft and his hunting weapons to take with him. He will be given food, too."
Ayla nodded. She speared a rather large piece of meat, took one end in her teeth, then, holding the other, cut off the piece in her mouth with her knife and put the rest back on her scapula bone plate. She chewed for a while with a thoughtful expression, then swallowed.
"Chevenar's clothes were beautiful. So many little pieces all sewn together into a pattern like that," she commented. "Animals and designs. It almost seemed to tell a story."
"In a way it does," Willemar said, smiling. "That's how people are recognized, distinguished from one another. Everything on his ceremonial outfit means something. It has to have his Alandan and his mates, and, of course, the Zelandanyi Abalon."
Ayla looked puzzled. "I don't understand those words. What's an Alandan or a Zelandanyi Abalon?" she asked.
Everyone looked at Ayla with surprise. They were such commonly used terms, and Ayla spoke Zelandanyi so well, it was hard to believe she didn't know them. Jandalar looked a bit chagrined.
"I guess the words never came up," he said. "When you found me, Ayla, I was wearing Sharamadoy clothes, and they don't have quite the same way of showing who a person is. The Mamutoy have something similar, but not the same. A Zelandanyi Abalon is a... well, it's like those tattoos on the sides of Zelandani's and Marthona's forehead," the man tried to explain.
Ayla looked at Marthona, then Zelandani.
She knew all the Zelandania and the leaders had an elaborate tattoo made up of squares and rectangles of different colors, sometimes embellished with additional lines and swirls, but she'd never heard a name for the mark.
"Perhaps I can explain the meaning of the words," Zelandani said. Jondalar looked relieved. "I suppose we should start with Elan. You do know that word."
"I heard you use it today," Ayla said. "It means something like spirit or life force, I think."
"But you didn't learn this word before?" Zelandani asked, scowling at Jondalar.
"Jondalar always said spirit. Is that wrong?"
Ayla said. "No, it's not wrong. And I suppose we do tend to use Elan more when there is a death or a birth, because death is the absence or end of Elan, and birth is the beginning," the Danyar said. "When a child is born, when a new life comes into this world, it is filled with Elan, the vital force of life," the one who was first said. "When the child is named, a Zelandani creates a mark that is a symbol for that spirit, that new person, and paints it or carves it on some object, a rock, a bone, a piece of wood. That mark is called an Avalon. Each Avalon is different and is used to designate a particular individual. It might be a design made of lines or shapes or dots, or a simplified form of an animal. Whatever comes to mind when the Zelandani meditates about the infant."
"That's what Kreb, the Mogur, used to do. Meditate to decide what a new baby's totem was,"
Ayla said, surprised. She wasn't alone.
"You are talking about the clan man who was the Zelandani of your clan?"
the Danyar asked.
"Yes," Ayla said, and nodded.
"I'll have to think on that," the large woman said, more astounded than she wanted to let on. "To continue, the Zelandani meditates, then decides on the mark. The object with the mark on it, the symbol object, is the Elandan. The Zelandani gives it to the baby's mother to keep safe until the child is grown. When they pass into adulthood, the mother gives her children their Elandans as part of their coming-of-age ceremony. But the symbol thing, the Elandan, is more than just a material object with designs painted or engraved on it. It can hold the Elan, the life force, the spirit, the essence of each member of the cave, much the way a Danyi can hold the mother's spirit. The Elandan has more power than any other personal item. It is so powerful that in the wrong hands it can be used against a person to create terrible afflictions and adversity. Therefore, a mother keeps her children's Elandans in a place known only to her, and perhaps her mother or her mate. Suddenly, Ayla realized that she would be responsible for the Elandan of the child she was carrying. Zelandani explained that when the Elandan was given to a child who had reached adulthood, that person would hide it in a place known only to the new adult, often quite far away. But an innocuous object, like a stone, would be picked up from close by as a surrogate and given to a Zelandani, who customarily put it in a crack in a stone wall of a sacred place, perhaps a cave, as an offering to the Great Mother. While the thing that was offered seemed insignificant, its meaning was much greater. It was understood that Dani could trace the surrogate back to the original symbol thing, and from that to the person to whom it belonged, without anyone, not even a Zelandani, knowing where the Elandan was hidden. Willemar tactfully added that the Zelandania, as a whole, were highly respected and considered trustworthy and beneficial.
"But they are very powerful," he said. "For many people, a touch of apprehension is part of the respect they command, and any individual Zelandani is only human. A few have been known to misuse their knowledge and abilities, and some people fear that given the opportunity, one of those might be tempted to use a powerful object like the Elandan against someone they disliked, or to teach a person a lesson if they felt they had been wronged. I have never known it to happen, but people do like to embellish stories."
If anyone disturbs a person's symbol thing, it could make a person sick or even die. Let me tell you an elder legend, Marthona said. In the past, it is said, some families used to put all their symbol things together in the same place. Sometimes even entire caves put them all in one place. There was one cave that put all their symbol things together in a special little cave in the side of a hill near their shelter. It was considered such a sacred place that no one would dare to disturb them. One very wet spring, an avalanche washed down the slope, destroying the cave and everything in it. The people blamed each other and stopped being cooperative. Without each other's help, life became very difficult. The people scattered, and the cave died. So people learned that if someone disturbed all the Alandans, or even if they were dislodged by natural shifts caused by water, wind, or earth movements, the family or cave had serious problems. That is why each person needs to hide her own symbol thing. It is all right to put surrogate stones together, Zelandani added. The mother appreciates them, and she can trace them back, but they are just little tokens, not the real Alandans. Ayla was delighted with the legend. She had heard people talk about the elder legends, but she didn't realize they were stories told to help people understand things they needed to know. They reminded her of stories that old Dorf used to tell Brun's clan in the winter. Then the Danyer continued. The Abalon is a symbol or mark or pattern that always has life force associated with it. It is used specifically to identify or characterize someone from some group. The Zelandanyi Abalon identifies all of us and is the most significant. It is a symbol made of squares or rectangles, often with variations and embellishments. It may be different colors or made of different materials or even different numbers of squares, but it must have the basic shapes. Part of this is a Zelandanyi Abalon, she said, pointing to the mark tattooed on the side of her forehead. Ayla noticed that three rows of three squares were part of the design. The squares tell anyone who sees it that my people are Zelandanyi. Because one can count nine of them, the mark also identifies me as a member of the ninth cave. There is more to this tattoo, of course, she continued. It also marks me as a member of the Zelandanya and declares that I am considered by the other Zelandanya as first among those who serve the Great Earth Mother. Although no longer as significant, a part of it is also my own personal Abalon. You will notice that Marthona's tattoo is different from mine, although parts of it are the same. Ayla turned to examine the former leader's tattoo. Marthona tilted her head to show it better. There are the nine squares, Ayla said, but the mark is on the other side of her forehead, and there are other marks, more curved. Now that I look at it, one of them seems to have the shape of a horse, from the neck, across the back, and down the hind legs. Yes, Marthona said. The tattoo artist was very good and captured the essence of my Abalon. Though more stylized so that it could work with the whole pattern, it is very close to the mark on my Elandon, which is a horse, but simplified like that. Our tattoos tell you something about each of us, Zelandani said. You know that I serve the mother because mine is on the left. You know that Marthona is, or was, a leader of her cave because hers is on the right side of her forehead. You know we are both Zelandanyi, because of the squares, and that we are of the ninth cave. I think Manvelar's tattoo had three squares, but I don't remember if I could count up to 14 squares on Bramaval's forehead, Ayla said. No, you couldn't, Zelandani said. Caves are not always identified by the number of squares, but a person's cave is always identified in some way. Bramaval's tattoo has 14 dots in a certain shape. Not everyone has tattoos, Ayla said. Willemar has a small one on the middle of his forehead, but Jondalar doesn't have one at all.
Only people who are leaders have tattoos on their foreheads, Jondalar said.
Zelandani is a spiritual leader. Mother was a cave leader. Willemar is the trade master. It is an important position, and his advice is often asked, so he is also considered a leader.
Though most people would rather show who they are with their clothes, like Chevenar, some people have tattoos on other places, their cheeks or chins, even hands, usually someplace that shows and is not covered up by clothes. Not much point in putting an identifying mark where no one can see it. The other tattoos often show something a person wants to be recognized for, but usually it's a personal achievement, not a primary tie relationship, Marthona said.
Among the Mamutoi, the Mamuti, that's like Zelandanya, have tattoos on their cheeks, but not squares. They use chevrons, Ayla said. They start with a diamond shape, which is like a square turned so that it points up and down, or half of that, a triangle. They particularly like downward-pointing triangles. Then they repeat the pointed shape, like one point nestled inside another. Sometimes they connect them and make zigzags. All those symbols have meanings, too. Mamut was just starting to teach them to me the winter before I left.
Zelandani and Marthona caught each other's eyes and nodded a slight acknowledgement. The Danyar had talked with the former leader about Ayla's abilities and suggested that she, perhaps, ought to consider affiliating with the Zelandanya in some way. They both agreed that it might be better for her and everyone else.
Then Chevenar's tunic has his mark, his Abalon, and the Zelandanyi Abalon, Ayla stated, as though learning a lesson by rote.
Yes, he will be recognized by everyone, including Dani. The Great Earth Mother will know that he is one of her children who lived in the southwest region of this land, Zelandani said.
But that is only part of the design on Chevenar's ceremonial tunic. The entire outfit has meaning, including the necklaces. Besides the Zelandanyi Abalon, part of the pattern includes the 9 squares that identify his cave and other patterns that define his lineage. There are symbol marks for the woman he mated, the Abalons of her children born to his hearth. His craft, spear-making, is represented, and of course his own symbol mark. His Abalon is the most personal and personally powerful element of all. His ceremonial outfit, which are his burial clothes now, are, I suppose you could say, a visual display of his names and ties.
Chevenar's ceremonial outfit is particularly nice, Marthona said. It was created by the old pattern maker, who is gone now. He was very good.
Ayla had thought the clothing of the Zelandanyi was very interesting, some of it quite beautiful, particularly Marthona's things, but she'd had no idea of the complexity of the meanings associated with it. Some things had seemed too ornate for her taste. She had learned to appreciate the pure form and usefulness of the things she made, just as her clan mother did. Occasionally she varied the pattern in a basket she was weaving, or showed off the grain of the wood in a bowl or cup she carved and sanded smooth, but she had never added decorations. Now she was beginning to understand how the clothes and jewelry that people wore, as well as their facial tattoos, characterized and identified them. Chevenar's ensemble, for all that it was highly decorated, was one that she felt had a balanced and pleasing pattern. She was surprised, however, when Marthona said that it had been created by an old man.
Chevenar's clothes must have taken a lot of work. Why would an old man spend so much time making clothes? Ayla asked.
Jondalar smiled. Because the old man's craft was designing ceremonial and burial clothing. That's what a pattern maker does.
The old man didn't make Chevenar's ceremonial clothes. He planned how they would go together, Marthona said. There are so many aspects to include. It takes a special skill and an artistic eye to put them together in a pleasing way. But he could arrange to have the clothes made. Several people had worked closely with him for many years, and the team was in great demand. Now one of them plans the clothing,
but she isn't as good, not yet.
But why would the old man or anyone else do it for Chevenar?
Ayla asked.
He traded for it,
Jandalar said. Ayla frowned. It was obvious she still didn't quite understand.
I thought people traded with other camps or caves. I didn't know they traded with people in their own cave.
But why not? Willemar said. Chevenar was a spearmaker. He was known for his well-made spears, but he couldn't arrange all the elements and symbols he wanted to show on his ceremonial outfit in a way that pleased him. So he traded 20 of his finest spears for that outfit, and he prized it greatly.
It was one of the last the old man made, Marthona said.
After his eyes no longer allowed him to practice his craft, he traded Chevenar's spears, one by one, for other things he wanted, but he saved the best one for himself. His bones are now buried in sacred ground, but he took that spear with him to the spirit world. It was one that had both his and Chevenar's abalons on it.
If he is especially pleased with his handiwork, Jandalar explained, along with the abalon of the person it is being made for, a spearmaker sometimes incorporates his own symbol mark within the design carved or painted on it.
Ayla learned during the hunt that certain marks on spears were very important. She knew that every spear carried a mark of its owner, so that there would be no doubt who had killed which animal. She didn't know that it was called an abalon, or that it was so important to the Zelandani. She had seen one dispute resolved because of the marks. Two spears had found the same animal, but only one was embedded in a vital organ. Though each spear bore the owner's symbol mark, she had heard the hunters talking about the spear makers. They always seemed to know who made each spear, whether or not it bore the mark of the one who made it. The style of the spear and the decorations on it declared the maker.
"What is your abalon, Jandalar?" she asked.
"It's not anything specific. It's just a mark. It looks like this," he said.
He smoothed out the dry dirt nearby and with his finger drew a line, then a second line that started parallel with the first line but converged to a point at the end. A small line joined the two lines near the pointed end.
"I always thought that when I was born, the Zelandani couldn't think of anything that day," he said. He looked at the first and grinned. "Or maybe it's the tail of an ermine, white with a black tip. I always liked those little ermine tails. Do you think my abalon could be an ermine?"
"Well, your totem is a cave lion," Ayla said, "just like mine. I think your abalon can be anything you say it is. Why not an ermine? Ermines are feisty little weasels, but pretty in winter, all white except for their black eyes and the black tips of their tails. Actually, their brown summer coats are not bad either." She thought for a moment, then asked, "What is Chevenar's abalon?"
"I saw one of his spears near his resting place," Jandalar said. "I'll get it and show you."
He quickly got the spear and showed her Chevenar's symbol mark. It was a stylized representation of a mouflon, a mountain sheep with large, curved horns.
"I should take that with me,"
Zelandani said. "We'll need it to make a copy of his abalon."
"Why do you need to make a copy?" Ayla asked.
"The same symbol that marked his spears, clothing, and other possessions will mark his grave post,"
Jandalar said. As they walked back toward their dwellings, Ayla thought about the discussion and drew a few conclusions on her own. Though the symbol object, the Alandan itself, was concealed, the symbol mark, the abalon that had been made on it, was known not only to the person it symbolized, but to everyone else. It did possess some power, especially for the one to whom it belonged, but not for someone